May it please the court, my name is Earl Rhodes. Registration number is 6723. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Young & Hockensmith in Grand Junction. I'm appearing on behalf of Eric Lloyd, Shirley Nichols, and Bruce Smith. I am asking to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
That will be up to you to keep track of, Richard.
Thank you. Let me just make a brief summary comment, and then let me go through my argument. The trial court determined that the separation agreements of July 12, 2005 were valid, and that the town took on the obligation to pay health insurance payments both for the ex-town employees and for their families. In addition, and this was for a period of time of August 1st, 2005 through April 30th, 2006. In addition, there were other obligations in the separation agreement, including not contesting unemployment and not making any, and on both parties, not making any defamatory statements. There were three contracts at issue, and the terms of the contracts were very similar, although the numbers are different. The town breached its obligations to the plaintiffs. The key event is that the town issued a check in the total amount of the premiums for the employees and their family for the period of time of August 1st, 2005 through April 30th, 2006 to Rocky Mountain HMO. Rocky Mountain and the town employees had withheld from their severance payments the monies to pay for the family portions. This is as to Lloyd and as to Nichols. Rocky Mountain HMO said, we will not take a lump sum payment, but we will accept monthly payments. The town never paid any monies to Rocky Mountain HMO for health insurance. The contention of the plaintiffs is that the town's conduct constituted breach by failing beginning on August 1st to make the monthly payments, and there was a continuous breach through this whole entire period of time. And in December 2005, the town repudiated the contract in its entirety. And the contention of the plaintiffs is, for the purpose of the attorney's fees provision in paragraph 13, that the town's breaches were knowing and intentional. The court issued a lengthy opinion and tried to grapple with all the issues in this case. But somehow, Mr. Smith, one of the plaintiffs, his claims seem to have gotten lost in the court's analysis. What happened was that after the Rocky Mountain HMO refused the payment, the town attorney, longtime town attorney, Ed Sands, tried to reconstruct the situation, try to find a way out of this to carry out the intention of the parties. The attorney's memo to the town is an exhibit, and he did that on approximately August 2nd, 2005. The town ratified the attorney's memo and his plan of action. There is no communication to Mr. Smith in regards to any attempted modification of the contract. Mr. Smith was different from Lloyd and Nichols because there was no dependent coverage, and because Mr. Smith was not caught up in the application of municipal code provisions, section 3.05.060. So there was no letter to Smith saying the thing should be done differently. Obviously, there was no consideration to Smith. Smith, by his conduct, did not accept any modification by the town, and there was no meeting of the minds between Smith and the town.
Mr. Rhodes, when you refer to attempted modification, was there any specific provision in the separation agreements as to how the insurance premiums would be paid?
Yes. Well, I'm not sure there was. I think, the parties had agreed there'd be a lump sum payment. The court found that...
That wasn't in the agreement, though, was it?
No. The court found that the town could carry out its obligations in a variety of manners, and one of those manners was to pay the money on a monthly basis. And the town chose not to do that. The town chose to do nothing. So,
my understanding was that the town Well, my understanding is the agreement is that, in the example of Lloyd, I'm just looking at that one, Lloyd and his spouse shall continue to receive coverage under the town's group health insurance policy through April 2006, subject to payment of spouse's coverage for Lloyd, by Lloyd. I don't understand why the arrangement that was worked out by the town is in breach of that. I mean, the town apparently arranged for coverage to continue and then said the way they wanted to handle it was to reimburse as bills were, monthly payments were made. Why is that a breach of that language that is in the agreement?
Well, it's a breach because the town never paid any monies to Rocky Mountain HMO. It never obtained the agreement of Mr. Lloyd to do it, and the town unilaterally lowered the amounts of money it was willing to pay on behalf of Mr. Lloyd from the amount set forth in the contract to by approximately 50%.
Saying that the original agreement required that the payments be made directly by the town to Rocky Mountain HMO?
Correct.
And where was that found?
Well, that's clearly in the intent of the agreements. Money was...
It's down what? Is that extrinsic evidence you're relying on? Or?
Well, that is the practice of the town before the agreement, and the agreement provides that the town shall continue to pay.
No, it doesn't. It shall continue to receive coverage under the town's group health insurance policy.
Well, the practice that had been engaged in, that the town withheld, well, the town paid a portion of the employee's premium, and the town took money out of the employee's check for the family. And the town made these payments. And it was the understanding of the parties that the town would cut a lump sum check, which it did, to pay all of this.
As you say, it was understanding the parties. Is there evidence in the record that shows that?
Yes, there's the check that the town cut before the employees left the employment of the town.
That would certainly be one way to perform it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that was the intent of the parties, that that'd be the only way it would be done.
Well, the trial court found that the town had a variety of ways it could meet its obligations, but the town chose not to follow any of them. And the point is that as to Mr. Smith, the town made no effort to communicate with Mr. Smith about any modification or any alternative method. As to Lloyd, there was no meaningful modification, as that could be understood by Colorado law. It was a significant modification that the town requested of Mr. Lloyd, that is, he would receive half the money that he was supposed to receive under the contract. There was no consideration paid for that modification. There was no meeting of the minds. The court got sidetracked on this issue of whether the attorney could bind his clients without their express consent. And the court basically found, based upon the Mountain States case, that the actions of Mr. Gratton bound the plaintiffs to a modification in the agreement. And the Mountain States case is clearly distinguishable. And the controlling law in Colorado, based upon the Cross case and upon Signer versus Zeff, is that attorneys have authority to negotiate, but only the clients have the power to agree, and none of that occurred. And in the Smith's case, that is most clear because there was no effort by the town to have him agree to anything else. And in the case of Nichols, her reduction of benefits that the town assumed went from $1,300 a month to $262 a month. All of this, which the town did unilaterally and without benefit of communication, a meeting of the minds, and without benefit of any consideration. So the basically the town is unilaterally doing things but not meeting any requirements of Colorado law in terms of modification or performance. The town repudiated the contract in its entirety in December of 2005, and the town filed counterclaims against the individuals, claiming the agreements were no good, claiming that the individuals had committed various torts against the town. And at that point, the town repudiated all responsibility.
So you hit your 5 minutes. Can I ask you one other question?
Yeah.
It's unclear to me what specifically relief you have request. In your brief, you say we'd like the case to be reversed.
Yes.
Which is a little, so you want to vacate all judgments and start from scratch?
No, we want the court, well, The trial court entered judgment in favor of plaintiffs Nichols and Lloyd for the amounts of money that the town wrongfully withheld. The trial court entered judgment in favor of Nichols and Lloyd as to those payments that were reimbursed by the town. That is, to those payments that Nichols and Lloyd did. We want judgment entered in favor. Well, we want the matter remanded for a new award of consequential damages. We want the judgment remanded as to the unemployment damages, which Smith held, and we want a finding that the breach by the town was knowing, intentional, and willful, which results in an attorney fee claim by the plaintiffs against the town. Thank you.
I'm going to ask you a question. You can turn the clock off. But because you may want to consult your materials before you answer it in your rebuttal. I'm, and I think all of us are very confused as to what exactly the proof was by Mr. Smith concerning his unemployment comp benefits had the city not breached the agreement by contesting them. I mean, we get unemployment sure. comp appeals from time to time.
Sure.
We're comfortable dealing with a referee's decision after a hearing. That doesn't seem to be in the record. Sometimes we deal with a deputy's decision that is then subject to challenge by the appeal. The deputy's decision doesn't seem to be in the record, so I'll speak only for myself. I'm very confused as to what exactly were the documents that Mr. Smith put in to prove that but for the city's breach of the agreement, he would have received a certain amount of unemployment benefits. And I'll leave you to examine your file if you wish to during while your opponent argues.
I know the answer.
All right, well then.
Mr. Smith submitted a notice of award, which had a $10,000 figure.
Okay, but is the notice of award, is that the deputy's decision?
It's a clerical decision.
Oh, but it's not the deputy's decision.
No.
And did the city then challenge the notice of award leading to a deputy's decision?
Yes. And ultimately, Mr. Smith was denied benefits.
Okay,
because of the town's conduct.
But the deputy's decision isn't in the record?
It is not.
Okay, was there an evidentiary hearing or did the unemployment proceedings end with the deputy's decision?
There was an evidentiary hearing.
So there's then a referee's decision?
Correct.
That isn't in the record either?
It is not.
Thank you.
May it please the court? Good afternoon. My name is Anna Eitenberg, registration number 31334. I represent the town of Colburn. I'm here with Sandy Karp. We are both with the law firm of Karp New Hanlon in Glenwood Springs. I would like to point out some important, what I submit are misstatements presented by Mr. Rhodes, significant, primarily that the town unilaterally reduced the payment of severance for anybody. The modification that's been at issue and that was resolved through trial was only to the manner of payment of the health insurance premiums. There was no reduction of any payment. The agreement expressly states for Ms. Nichols and Mr. Lloyd that they will be responsible for payments of spousal coverage. It states that the payments will continue to be sent to the health insurance provider, and then expressly states, quote, subject to payments of spouse's coverage by the plaintiff or by the employee.
Counsel, excuse me, would the that methodology be in breach of the original agreement if you didn't have the modification that you're claiming?
Can you clarify which methodology? By payment on a reimbursement basis? No, the agreements do not specify at all in the manner in which these premium payments must be made. As the trial court found, coverage was key. The manner of payment was mere detail, something like that. I believe that's very close to the express words used by the trial court. There was no discussion as to how it would be paid. There's no provision in the agreements as to how it would be paid. The issue was coverage. And the, as Mr. Rhodes said, the court set forth these different ways in which the town could accomplish coverage. And contrary to what Mr. Rhodes said, The town did not ignore any of them. The town selected one based on the advice of its attorney at that time, Mr. Sands, and notified the plaintiff's attorney at that time that that was the manner in which they proposed doing it. There are minutes from the board authorizing the town to do it in that manner with respect to all three plaintiffs. And then there's evidence in the record that through correspondence between Mr. Grattan and Mr. Sands and communications between Mr. Grattan and Mr. Sands and Mr. Grattan and the interim town clerk at that time, Ms. Entwistle, that that notification was agreed upon. The issue with the reduction in payments was something that was raised after the lump sum had been sent back. Ms. Nichols was one of the plaintiffs, one of the parties to the agreement. She was the one who wrote the lump sum check. She was the one who calculated everything. She was the one who withheld from the severance payments to her amounts that she thought the town was going to pay to the insurance provider for the spousal coverage. And then when the lump sum was returned, that money also should have been returned, and the town agreed with that. And as a matter of oversight, because they were incredibly short-staffed, they had like two people working there, as a matter of oversight, that money was not returned, and that issue was raised for the first time at trial, and that is why the court ordered the town to repay that money as a matter of unjust enrichment, not as part of the breach of contract. So the issue with that money, it was an oversight. It was an equitable theory that was raised through the evidence at trial. It was never pled. The court awarded it based on the facts at trial. There was no unilateral reduction in any payment. The only modification concerned the manner in paying the premiums. And to address Judge Webb, your question about the unemployment benefits to which Mr. Smith would have been entitled, the only evidence presented on that issue was the monetary determination of unemployment insurance benefits that set forth, it's Exhibit 15, Plaintiff's Exhibit 15, that set forth the maximum payable amount that Mr. Smith would be entitled to. And it expressly states that just because he's monetarily eligible for that amount does not automatically mean that he would receive benefits. That's just best case scenario under the law based on the calculation of unemployment taxes. And also submitted into evidence was the application for unemployment that Mr. Smith filled out. And it stated on there that he received 36 weeks of severance as part of the questions that were asked of him. And that could easily be the basis for the reduction or the denial of benefits to him. So the only evidence is that, and then this maximum determination in his testimony that he did not receive any benefits. So for those reasons, I believe that the trial court was correct in concluding that there was insufficient evidence as to what damages, if any, Mr. Smith suffered.
But were there documents presented showing what arguments the city made against Mr. Smith receiving unemployment benefits?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. As I stated, the only documents that I believe were submitted on the issue of Mr. Smith's benefits were this monetary determination and his application.
Even if the documents were, or the evidence was insufficient to show that he was damaged, wouldn't the city's breach of the agreements by protesting the unemployment lead to a greater award of attorney's fees under the agreements?
Well, the trial court found, and I believe the trial court was correct, is that to show breach of the agreement, as with breach of any contract, damages are an essential element. So while the plaintiff showed that the town did not comply with that provision, causation and damages were not established, and the agreement provides for an award of attorney's fees for a knowing breach.
Counsel, it's possible to have a breach of contract claim without actual damages, right? Nominal damages can be awarded. Specific performance can be awarded. So if you want to recover damages, you have to prove your damages.
I guess in some cases, specific performance can be awarded. I believe generally those are cases where money damages are insufficient or...
I'm not saying specific performance be appropriate in this case.
Well, the basic elements of breach of contract are, contract, breach, causation, and damages. I guess specific I apologize if I'm answering your question, but I guess specific performance can in some circumstances be awarded. I don't think this is the type of case where it was sought or it would have been awarded, and I don't know what kind of damage other than damages.
Nominal damage.
Typically are awarded.
Well, in addition to the issue of damages, I think the problem was proving causation. That, I mean, obviously his damages are the lack of unemployment benefits, but there's no proof that that loss of money was caused by actions taken by the town. So it's not just the element of damages, but also the element of causation.
But isn't that irrelevant to the fact that the city knowingly breached the agreement by contesting unemployment?
Well, again, I mean, but it goes back to what is a breach of contract, and just not complying with a provision in the contract is not a breach. I mean,
doesn't this go beyond non-complying? This isn't just negligence, like you said, about forgetting to cut the checks. This is affirmative action that somebody made a decision to undertake that directly contravenes a clause in the agreement. Why isn't that a knowing breach?
Because the way the agreement is written is that you have to prove breach before you get the attorney's fees, and they cannot prove that the violation of the agreement caused damages. I mean, it just goes back to the elements of breach.
I think
breach of contract, you don't have to prove just that the person did not comply with the agreement. Like I said before, you also have to show that caused some damages, and you have to prove all of those elements to establish the breach before the attorney's fees provision can kick in.
What authority are you relying on for that?
The elements that breach of contract. I'm turning to the court's order because he specifically addressed it.
Well, that's good. If you're relying on the authority that he cited, that's
well,
that's
I'm looking at the case now. I don't see a specific reference to something that says, to what says that you have to have offer, I mean, that you have to have a contract and then a breach and then damages, you know, and causation. It's the elements of contract law, but
that's fine. I see the authority the court cited. That's
okay. The other statement Mr. Rhodes made was that the town repudiated the agreement in its entirety, and again I disagree with that. I believe that what he's referring to is filing a lawsuit, and I don't think that if a party files a lawsuit, they asserted counterclaims in a lawsuit that was filed against them by the plaintiffs, and I don't believe, and I'm not aware of any authority that simply says if you are sued as a breaching party and then you assert affirmative defenses and counterclaims, that constitutes a repudiation of the agreement. And I don't believe there's any other evidence or authority that the plaintiffs are relying on to state that the town repudiated. And I also don't think that matters or is relevant. I believe the argument is that since they repudiated, they can't then require the plaintiffs to comply with the modified agreement, which is they can't require plaintiffs to submit the premiums as a condition to prepayment. And I address this in my brief in greater detail, and I refer you to that the requirement that they submit the premium before getting reimbursed is a condition precedent to the plaintiffs being satisfied in their benefits under the agreement. It's not the town. The town is not trying to seek any benefit from the plaintiff to them that they would have waived by allegedly repudiating anything.
What evidence is there in the record that the town renegotiated the manner of payment with Mr. Smith?
There are the letters that were drafted by the town attorney that were sent to the plaintiff's attorney, indicating that the town had considered these issues and the various manners of payment, and that they decided that the best way to go about satisfying the contract was to request premiums for reimbursement. There were subsequent conversations following that with Mr. Sands and Mr. Grattan, where, according to Mr. Sands' testimony, Mr. Grattan grudgingly accepted that that modification. Shortly following that, there was Mr. Grattan sending a premium for Mr. Smith to Mr. Sands for payment, and then the town went ahead and sent that payment.
Is the term modification, are you talking about a modification of the separation agreements, or just in a generic change in manner of making the insurance premium?
I am definitely not saying that it's any sort of substantive modification that would require consideration, and it's not of the level of a settlement agreement. That's the kind of contract that's the subject of cases that the plaintiffs are relying on to say that you need consideration and you need all this higher standards of offer and acceptance. It was just a manner to fulfill the promise, the agreed upon promises in the contract. The contract said they would pay insurance benefits. It was a manner to fulfill that.
Did Mr. Smith advise the city that he was cashing that check under protest?
I believe at that point all communications were between Mr. Grattan and Mr. Sands, the party's attorneys. There was some note that he gave to his attorney that said that he wanted to sue the town for all money owing to him in punitive damages. That was sent when the payments were still timely. That was sent about a month after the settlement agreement was signed. And then that was prior to conversations that took place between Mr. Grattan and Mr. Sands talking about this method of payment. And I'm sorry, to finish up on your question, Judge Webb, there's also communications between the town clerk, as I mentioned, and Mr. Grattan, where she confirmed that the town fully intended to comply with its obligations on this reimbursement basis. And then there was the evidence that the three premiums were submitted by the plaintiff's attorney and to the town for reimbursement. I also want to note that the issue of whether Mr. Grattan did or did not have authority was never raised at the trial court. The plaintiffs testified that they would never have agreed to that modification. The specific legal question of whether or not they authorized Mr. Grattan and what was the scope of his authority and whether agreeing to that modification was inside or outside the scope of that authority was never brought up at trial. I have 5 seconds remaining.
Well, I gave Mr. Okay. Rhodes an extra minute or so to explain the unemployment. So go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, that would I just think that they are precluded from raising it for the first time on appeal. That case of Steiner versus Zeff that talks about an attorney's ability to accept a settlement and compromise on behalf of their client, that was cited for the first time in a reply in support of the Rule 59 motion following trial. I just don't believe that it was an issue, and they're precluded from raising it now. And I believe it's not valid anyway for the reasons set forth in my brief. But thank you.
Very briefly, the position of the town is that it had an obligation to make health insurance payments, but that there was flexibility about how that could be done. Communication was had with Mr. Grattan, who represented the plaintiffs in this matter, and based upon these verbal communications, there was an agreement that the plaintiffs would pay for the health insurance and then be reimbursed. This argument ignores the substance of the claims of both Lloyd and Nichols, which is that the letters, or draft letters, which were sent to plaintiff's counsel, set forth the position of the town that it would only pay a drastically reduced amount of money on behalf of Lloyd and Nickel.
Let me focus in on that.
Sorry.
Is what you refer to as the drastically reduced amount the difference between the employee's coverage and the additional cost of coverage for spouses and dependents, if any?
Yes, hold on.
Well, I don't need the exact figures, but that's what we're talking about.
Right.
Okay, well, the city was never going to pay that additional cost with its own funds, was it?
Well, the city, as to Mr. Lloyd, had been paying... the cost to Mr. Lloyd and his family for health insurance was $1,014 a month. The town had been paying $850. Mr. Sands, on behalf of the town, said to Mr. Lloyd, we are not going to pay you the $850. We instead are going to pay you $507 a month. So that was the reduction that the town offered as part of this would-be modification.
All right. Again, I apologize.
No.
The 500 and some odd dollars is what Mr. Lloyd's coverage costs, correct?
The Lloyd family total was $1,014 a month. The town had been paying $850 a month. The town offered to pay $507 a month.
As part of this modification?
That's correct.
Okay. Does the $507 have a basis in fact, like it is?
Yes.
That's Mr. Lloyd's individual coverage.
Correct.
Okay, so we got three numbers. We got the 500.
Right.
We got the 850.
Right.
And we've got the 1,000.
Right.
All right. Between the 850 and the 1,000, the city was never paying that out of its own funds.
Correct.
All right. Was the city paying out of its own funds the difference between the 500 and the 800?
Yes.
Okay. And is there any evidence in the record as to why the city then, in your view, reneged on that portion of its obligation?
Yes.
What's the evidence?
The evidence in the record is that Ed Sands, the town attorney, wrote a memo to the town saying, I've looked at this, and I see that there's a town code provision 3.05.060, which says the town is only obligated to pay a maximum of 50%. It can either be the whole amount for the individual or 50% for the family. And so the town unilaterally reduced the amount it said it would pay from the 1014 to the 507. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I just don't understand, because the agreement says that the payment is subject to payment of spouse's coverage by Lloyd.
Yes.
So why would they have any obligation to pay for the spouse's coverage?
Well, let me address that. What in fact occurred is at the time of the separation, Lloyd and Nichols withheld monies from their severance check to pay the amounts that both parties understood were the family portion. So that's what actually happened. And analytically, what's going on, and the case of Ms. Nichols is perhaps more clear, her family premium at the time of separation was $1,300 a month. The town offered in this modification process to pay the sum of $262.50, and that's because she was 65 at the time and got on Medicare. So it's a very substantial reduction in the amount of money that the town offered to pay. And it's based upon that these concepts of consideration for a modification come into play. This is no procedural issue. This is no just who pays first. This is very substantive. I think my time is out. Well, I would just say to the court, as to this question about Smith's damages, the court refused to find that there were any damages by Smith as to the unemployment. We think that was incorrect. The court should have gone through the analysis of determining what he should have received and taken into consideration the town's arguments. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. We will issue a written opinion in due course.